Good evening, Truth Seekers. Mike Malloy here. Maybe the last time I say that to you. Woohoo! It is 7 past the hour. Here we are on Rapture Eve. I can't believe that a handful of crazy people has gotten so much attention. But anyway, we will play along for a little bit tonight. Oh, by the way, this hour is sponsored by Alice at Helen Hollers. Her message: on this eve of the end of the world, I will remind all truth seekers to get a jar of healing salve to take with them to the lake of fire. It works really well on burns. You can get this by going to MikeMalloy.com and clicking on Helen Hollers' banner ad. Healing salve to take with them to the lake of far. All right. We have podcast trivia tonight in about an hour or so. So stick around for that. Let's see. Mark Perkel, who at one time was, wasn't he our webmaster at one time, Kathy? Yeah, back in the day. He is now a minister in the Church of New Reality or something. I'm sorry, Mark. Anyway, he writes, I'm not sure what bothers me more, that people are actually foolish enough to believe the end of the world is Saturday, or that all the donations to fund this nonsense is tax deductible. Because those who believe these crazy ideas get to deduct the donations from their taxes, the rest of us have to pay more taxes to make up for what they don't pay. I have to say that I object to tax policies that fund this nonsense at my expense. Churches shouldn't be taxed, but they shouldn't be tax deductible either. I believe if you want to believe, you have the right to do that, but not on my nickel. Mark Perkel. I thought it was not on my dime. Oh, well, Mark, thanks. There's always that argument, right? Bridget at fairywoodland.com. The makers of all things fairy, writes, oh, she has a press release from the land of the fairies. It says, let me see here, it's hard to read this. It's written in Elvish. Fairy sprites and other nature spirits are very excited about the possibility of humans being raptured. We fairies want our planet back. Okay. Can't say I blame him. And from Denny, north-northwest of L.A., Mike, Kathy, Molly, and fellow truth seekers, goodbye and keep it lit. Final regards, Denny, north-northwest of L.A. P.S., what you got for Monday? But
I'm going to be pissed. I'm buying all these plants tomorrow for the backyard, all these bushes.
Pissed about what?
Pissed about the work I'm going to do if I'm not one of the chosen. I'm not done by, I guess I just need to be, wait till 6, I guess.
Today is Malcolm X's birthday, Judy B. writes, and the world ends tomorrow. Coincidence? I think not. Just saying, Judy B. I got so many emails about this from Tim in L.A. and the Malloy chat room on Ustream. Mike, mental illness is a sad thing. We are blessed to have a healthy mind where drugs are not necessary. The need for single-payer health care is a must, as these humans need support in learning how to cope with everyday life, the Rapture people. Yet, there are those who aren't ill but choose to follow a path that can lead to mental illness. Their illness is based on a book of fiction that so many hold on to as truth, that if their wishes, or as they put it, the fulfillment of their belief is not accomplished, who knows what will happen. I'm talking about the rapture of the religious folks that the religious folks are claiming just after your show. just after their show. Growing up in a church, I learned a few things, and I learned where the root cause of this mental illness stems. And he cites Thessalonians. According to the Lord's own word, we tell you that we who are still alive, who are left till the coming of the Lord, will certainly not precede those who have fallen asleep. That means no rapture. For the Lord himself will come down from heaven with a loud command, with the voice of the archangel, and with the trumpet call of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. After that, we who are still alive and are left will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so we will be with our Lord forever. Thessalonians, 1 Thessalonians, chapter 4, verses 15 through 17. And Tim writes, and this is what the hubbub is all about, what they believe will happen just after your show ends. Yet, like typical right-winged Christian nutcases who are not mentally challenged but choose to believe selectively, they conveniently forget what their master had said in Matthew 24, verse 36. No one knows about that day or hour, not even the angels in heaven or the Son, but only the Father. Tim writes, if the Son of the Sky Spook doesn't know when the rapture is, what makes anyone think that these rapture folks would know? But even more frightening than the rapture not happening are the people who aren't raptured. What will they do? Will they commit suicide, or will they be so damn distraught that they were left behind? And those who are like you, me, and every rational, liberal, and progressive who are also left behind be targets for their insanity? I'm against censorship, but the Bible is an extremely dangerous text. Well, yeah, if you take it seriously, I guess, yeah. There's a website, Rapture website. Say that 10 times real fast. That Cindy sent me a link to, raptureletters.com. And on the main page here, it says, the rapture, when all the believers in Jesus Christ who have been born again are taken up to heaven. After the rapture, there will be a lot of speculation as to why millions of people have just disappeared. Unfortunately, after the rapture, only non-believers will be left to come up with answers. You probably have family and friends that you have witnessed to, and they just won't listen. After the rapture, they probably will, but who will tell them? We have written a computer program to do just that. It will send an electronic message, email, to whomever you want, after the rapture has taken place and you and I have been taken up to heaven. How is this accomplished, you might ask? It's a dead man's switch that will automatically send the emails when it is not reset. If you wish to do something now to help your unbelieving friends and family after the rapture, you need to add those persons' email addresses to our database. Their names will be stored indefinitely, and a letter will be sent out to each of them on the first Friday after the rapture. Then they will receive another letter every Friday after that. If you would like to see one of the letters which will be sent after the rapture, click here. Thank you, and God bless you. And then this is from Blue Lady, who sent this to me, Cindy. And then it says on the letter page, this service is free of charge. We require no payment for our efforts to save the lost. But because this ministry does have financial needs, we do accept donations. Without them, we would not be able to create the program. We would not have been able to create the program, maintain the database, or this website. 90% of all donations we receive are used to further the kingdom of God. 10% goes toward administration costs. Click on donate for secure PayPal transactions. This is a personal ministry. If you have any questions or comments, please address them to info@raptureletters.com. Thank you, and may God bless you. And the guy who's running the scam, what did I read the other day? He has a net worth of, what have they collected? 70 million or 170 million? Or remember what it said. Remember what Jesus said. Easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than Newt Gingrich to ever be elected president. As we know it, it's me.
Flying Monkey Free Fun and Frivolity with Mike Malloy.
It's about 22 past the hour. This hour is sponsored by Helen Hollers. Alice at Helen Hollers, her message. On this eve at the end of the world, I remind all truth seekers to get a jar of healing salve to take with them to the lake afar. It works really well on burns. Go to her website. You can get there by clicking on the link at MikeMalloy.com. Helen Hollers. Earlier this week, I jumped all over Eric Cantor because he had a private meeting with the traders and the owners of CME, a futures trading group. They work in all kinds of stuff. They drive up prices. They sell contracts. They don't produce anything. They shuffle paper, and they make sure that everybody else pays more for commodities, whether those commodities are soybeans or oil. And I thought I did a pretty good job of busting Cantor and the Republicans, but it was not to be. I got an email here from James in Seattle. Here's what he writes. Under the subject line, please, a little clarity, writes, Malloy, I love you, man, but you're killing me. Sure, Eric Cantor is a complete swine, but the Dodd-Frank Act is somewhere between 20 times to 50 times worse than the Commodity Futures Modernization Act. So you're buying into the political theater of the absurd. You do realize that Dodd's wife is an executive with CMA, including while Dodd was writing that legislation, earning a very handsome salary? No, I didn't know that. You do realize that at least three pieces of legislation were passed in Congress to curb Dodd's father's incredible corruption? No, I didn't know that. You do realize that Barney Frank's former staffer, now a lobbyist with Goldman Sachs, handed him, Frank, portions of that act written by Goldman Sachs, which Barney Frank placed into the legislation with absolutely no changes? No, I didn't know that. Next, you read Prairie 2's letter with further misinformation. Sure, Ben Stein and Eric Cantor should both be waterboarded in hell, but that guy, the former assistant director of the FBI, now deceased, he was never deep throat. After all, supposing he was, which is totally not true, how in the bloody hell did he come by that information from directly in the Oval Office? Conveniently ignored and never explained. Also impossible, as Nixon had both the U.S. Secret Service and private companies do a bug sweep of his White House offices every day. You had Russ Baker on your show, the guy that wrote Family of Secrets and now has a website, Who, What, Why. Didn't you even listen to anything he said? Bob Woodward worked in an office in the White House when he was with the Naval Investigation Service, which is comparable to the Army's CID, and part of his mission was doing background checks on members of the White House Communications Agency. Now, who do you suppose set up Nixon's taping equipment in the Oval Office and elsewhere? Correct, Malloy, it was the White House Communications Agency techs. There was never any deep throat, but Woodward's contacts within that outfit. You're adding to the misinformation and confusion out there, Mr. Malloy. Okay. Look. I'll plead guilty. I've never said that people should come to this program for to learn anything. But Jesus, God, I mean, busting me on about five different levels there. No, I have no idea who these people, you know, all this stuff about Barney Frank's wife, or not Barney Frank's wife, but Barney Frank's staffer and Chris Dodd's wife and A plus B equals C. And did I know about Bob Woodward and the Naval? No, I don't know that stuff. I'm sorry. Am I putting out misinformation? I try not to. But if I am, I apologize. I don't want to sound like a smartass here, James, but maybe you would prefer. And I get this not just from James. I've gotten this from other people, too. Not on this topic, but I mean over the course of doing this show. Maybe I should submit online a list of the topics I'm going to cover on a particular night. And then the people who know more than I do, which is a big number of my audience, can peruse what I put out there, find the mistakes, and send the corrections before I make them. before I make the mistakes? Huh? What do you think? You think that would work? I'm not sure. I don't know. Okay, so, I screwed up. I certainly did. All right, we'll be back in, I think we'll be back. I don't know. We're having trouble finding some music. Do-do-do-do-do. I can sing. Did you all... You know, tell me if this is a coincidence. Mary Hart, the host of Entertainment Tonight, retires tonight. It was her big going away show. Did you see that? And tomorrow's the rapture. Coincidence? I think not.
It'll be our secret.
25 before the hour. This hour is sponsored by Alice at Helen Hollers. Helen Hollers. She writes, on this eve of the end of the world, I remind all true seekers to get a jar of healing salve to take with them to the lake afar. It works really well on burns. And if you want one, go to her banner ad at MikeMalloy.com. Time for some prairie, too. Digging a ditch instead of a hole. His cryptic subject lines. Prairie 2 writes, weekly unemployment claims are continuing to trend down. The spike in claims a couple of weeks ago has been blamed on an unusual number of schools all having spring break at the same time. So all the teachers, I don't know. Last month saw 244,000 new jobs created, according to a survey of employers. This may or may not have been included, or may or may not have included, the 62,000 people Mickey D's hired for the summer season. Most of these people won't end up with permanent jobs, even if they want to push burgers and high fructose corn syrup for the rest of their lives. McDonald's has no incentive to pay very well, since nearly a million people applied for a job that barely pays more than minimum wage. The real minimum wage should be $12 to $14 an hour to match what it would buy when it was first set up at 25 cents an hour in 1938. This number also matches up to the minimum wage of the early 60s, when McDonald's was first going nationwide. Way back in those days, McDonald's hired mostly high school kids. And it was a really good job, since it paid much more than minimum wage. Can you imagine such a job paying the equivalent of $18 an hour today? Only the cool kids and jocks got hired, and you could pay for college working there. And it was hard to get a McDonald's franchise back then, since they weren't building one on every corner. That all changed under Reagan, who created a guaranteed low-wage workforce in post-union America. And the fries with that? Service economy was born. 2009 graduates who are now 2 years into the American dream find that 22% are still unemployed and 23% have jobs that don't require a degree. Fries with that? That is almost half of the graduating class of 2009. That may well have wasted 4 years and tens of thousands of dollars that they can't ever get out of paying back unless they die. The median income of the class of 2009 is only $30,000 a year, so it's no wonder that 57% of college students and their parents rate colleges as doing only fair or poor in providing good value for the cost of a college degree. McDonald's doesn't need to hire high school kids anymore. They can get college grads and grandmothers. Grandfathers work as greeters at Walmart. And the $30,000 a year that a 2009 college grad makes works out to a little more than $14 an hour, or the equivalent of the minimum wage a ditch digger with a shovel made in 1938. We've been told that we no longer want those dirty manufacturing jobs, but jobs that take a college degree are being outsourced to India, the Philippines, and China, even faster than factory jobs. And they bring in H-1B visa workers to drive down American wages on other jobs. Some people have been back to the community college four times to retrain after being outsourced. Employers used to pay for this retraining, but no more. Almost no one who was laid off in the last 3 years has gotten employer-paid retraining. The government has little incentive to force employers to do this, since colleges are full of capacity with people paying for it themselves, and you wouldn't want to tax the job creators anyway, right? That ditch-digging job that paid 25 cents an hour might not seem like much, but it was in fact a productive job that accomplished something for the good of society and created real wealth. The fries with that? Jobs produce exactly nothing. But move a lot of high fructose corn syrup. Health experts predict that one-third of today's kids will develop type 2 diabetes in their lifetime. But hey, that's more jobs in the medical field that pay pretty good. A win-win for the service economy. PrairieNumeral2.com. I detect a bit of sarcasm in tonight's email from Prairie 2. A bit of sarcasm indeed. Have you, before I move on, regarding that bit about CME that James in Seattle found my reporting on very, very lacking in positive substance regarding that, there is this. I got an email today from Oxfam America. I'm sure you're familiar with them. Relief agency. And global relief. It says, my global food prices could more than double within 20 years unless immediate steps are taken by U.S. policymakers and businesses to roll back pressures on our food system. That's the stunning headline from a new report to be released on June 1st by International Relief and Development Organization Oxfam. The report will be released as part of the launch of a new global campaign supported by world leaders and high-profile celebrities, including Archbishop Desmond Tutu. The campaign will advocate for emergency fixes to the broken food system that leaves nearly one in seven people hungry and skyrocketing prices hitting consumers hard. Now, there's more in this email, but the reason this is going on, the reason a billion people worldwide, one in seven, go to bed hungry every night, the reason for all this, of course, is the fact that, first of all, globalization in this hemisphere, NAFTA, and companies like CME that sell contracts that bid up the price of future food or bid it down. When they bid it up, they bid it to a point where countries that need to import food simply can't afford it. And why don't they go ahead and grow food? Because given the pressures of globalization, in so many instances, it's cheaper, it has been cheaper, to import food. So you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. None of this has to happen. None of it. A lot of people can make an argument in favor of commodity futures trading organizations. I say burn them to the ground. Metaphorically speaking, get rid of them. Deny them a license to do business. Well, what's the point? I've heard some people say, well, it guarantees future prices for farmers so that when they plant their crops, if there's locusts or one of the other plagues out of the Bible, they still will get paid because they've already sold. Well, but if the locusts eat everything, there's nothing to sell. I say burn them to the ground. Get rid of them. Derivatives organizations. What the hell? What good do they do? Seriously, they don't produce anything. They shuffle paper around, which makes a certain cadre of 0.01% even more filthy rich, while people around the globe go hungry because of this manipulation. I say burn them to the ground. Dig a hole. Shovel them in. Close the hole. Put a marker on top of it. Here lies the people, capitalists all, who tried to destroy millions of people around the globe and are doing a very effective job. You know, there's ways to wage war that have nothing to do with bombs and missiles and airstrikes and shock and awe. You just price food beyond the ability of people to afford to pay for it, which these people do. Because after all, it's about money. That's what capitalism is about. You know, I've mentioned on this program many times, capitalism is called capitalism because it's about capital. It's not about people. Otherwise, it'd be called peopleism. Right? Oh, wait a minute. There's another word. Socialism. Ooh, the devil word. Market socialism makes a hell of a lot more sense than the kind of predatory capitalism that is now the dominant, the only form of capitalism that's out there. Because capitalism has pushed to the extent where it can't push anymore. The only thing it can do now is shuffle paper. It can't build new industries. Well, it can. But the workers who go into those industries are no longer allowed, in most of the countries that are getting the new industries, to unionize, to organize, to collectively bargain. You know, those countries, those poor third world countries like Wisconsin and Michigan and places like that, Ohio. Anyway, just a little aside there about CME. Have you made up your mind about Dominique Strauss-Kahn? Have you got it all straight? Nah. Guilty, evil son of a bitch, right? Hitting on a immigrant janitor worker or housekeeper or whatever she was. Are you? Have you got it all straight? You know what he's charged with, and he's out on bond now, right? But have you made up your mind? Do you know, I pretty much had until I started reading some stuff that people were sending me. I'll share a little bit of it with you when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. You're gonna spread your wings. You're gonna retake the sky. But until that morning, they're gonna work you for peanuts.
Before
the hour, this hour has been sponsored, maybe the last time she'll do it, by Alice at Helen Hollers. Her link to her website is on MikeMalloy.com. She makes that, what is that, lemon hemp cream? Oh my God, that stuff is good. You put that on a piece of toast in the morning. No, just kidding. It's great. It's the best hand cream in the world. But her message, on this eve of the end of the world, I remind all true seekers to get a jar of healing salve to take with them to the lake afar. It works really well on burns. Yeah, the healing salve works good too. Not just on burns. That's good for cracks and wrinkles and, you know, stuff like that. What?
No, I love that stuff. When I've been working in the garden and I get all those little calluses on my hands, it just seems to eat them away and make them soft as Molly's little cheeks.
Eat them away? Careful.
It's great. No, and it's a little, it's got a little grain to it. I think it's the ground up hemp seeds, but it feels good.
All right. Dominique Strauss-Kahn. How to put this? If he's guilty as charged of sexual assault, then he should feel the full force of the law, obviously. But there's just right now, is there not a lot of questions? I mean, there is to me. Maybe people have got this all figured out and filed it away, and you know that's the end of it. But Sheila sent me some questions that have been bothering her, and talking about how she's had a hard time trying to explain to other women. So you know, just some questions about this. Think about Elliot Spitzer, the guy who was spending his money with a high priced prostitute. And how he was on the verge of blowing the whistle on some of the people right before the bastards at all these financial institutions in New York pulled the plug and the rest of the world sank. And just before Elliot Spitzer was ready to file charges against who, I forget, or an investigation or whatever. I forget all the details. But Elliot Spitzer, all of a sudden, all this information comes pouring out about his sexual proclivities. And I don't know anything about Strauss-Kahn. But apparently... You know, a lot was made of the fact that he's a socialist. How could a socialist be head of the International Monetary Fund? Well, that's kind of an interesting question. How many people took the time to get an answer? I didn't. It just seemed like an oddity. A socialist head of the International Monetary Fund? Perry, too, explained it to me that a socialist in France is more like a liberal Democrat here. But still, socialist. So all of a sudden, I got a whole bunch of information that was sent to me, page after page of stuff, you know, articles and blogs and so on and so forth, about Strauss-Kahn. A whole lot of information that I certainly did not know. He was not one of the manic neoliberals that have been economically destroying the planet. Now, neoliberal has nothing to do with liberalism. It has to do with economic theory. Has to do with the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. And, you know, it says when a nation gets in debt, we'll come and bail you out, but you have to get rid of all your social services, safety net, get rid of everything, let people die and rot on the street, and we'll bail you out, but we want our money back. And the only salvation is the free market, free for the capitalists, certainly not free for people who have to live within that system. But that's neoliberalism, and, of course, it's a lot more complicated than that. Look it up on Wikipedia. But according to something in the WashingtonNote.com by Steve Clemens, there's a couple of paragraphs in here that I highlighted. Strauss-Kahn could see deeper global economic dependencies growing and simultaneously increasing the speed and scale of financial transactions. But in contrast to the U.S. ruling triumvirate of Robert Rubin, Lawrence Summers, and Alan Greenspan, Strauss-Kahn, this is a couple of years ago, this is back in 1998, Strauss-Kahn believed in healthy and robust regulation and monitoring. Strauss-Kahn has always been concerned about the human and national victims of an amoral global economic order. In 1998, Strauss-Kahn said that there was much to admire in what was happening in the U.S. with the boom in information technology and the inspirational aspects of what Bill Clinton was trying to sell as benign U.S.-led globalization. But Strauss-Kahn feared that America was blind to the downsides of economic deepening. around the world. And the U.S. needed to be careful about turning globalization into a religion. In so many ways, Dominique Strauss-Kahn's thoughts were highly prescient about the instabilities being cooked into an evolving global economic system in which manic deregulation and the triumph of markets were going to bring serious challenges. And there's so much more. And as you read about this guy and what he was about a decade ago, you can only come to one conclusion, and that is he was very hesitant. He was not, he's not a so-called neoliberal. He's a socialist. And while he believed in, I think probably, I'm just guessing here, he probably believed in market socialism. But the idea that he was about to institute some changes perhaps, and all of a sudden he's charged with sexual assault, not rape, sexual assault. Interesting. There's more on this. We'll, I'll maybe do some more of it when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
You want to...
Seven past the hour. This is the Malloy program. In about half an hour, we'll do podcast trivia, so stick around for that. This is a note that Sheila sent me. Sheila, who is connected to Op-Ed News, she wrote, Mike, I've been taking quite a beating from the women in my group who can't seem to get their minds around what is important here, that this creep, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, is also a human being entitled to democratic rights, legal due process, and the presumption of innocence until proven guilty. If I believe that, then I am against that poor maid who was attacked by a naked monster. My problem is with the tabloid media who first reported that the maid thought the room was empty because they aren't allowed to start cleaning until guests have cleared the premises. Then they reported that while she was cleaning the room, Strauss-Kahn charged naked out of the bathroom and brutally attacked her. No mention of why she was cleaning if the shower was running and there were clothes, a suitcase, etc. in plain view. Then they reported that the maid was in the hall outside the room and this naked monster charged out of the room, chased her down, dragged her back in while trying to rape her. This is what they tried to do to Julian Assange. If you can destroy a person's reputation, especially involving sex, then he has no credibility. Nobody, especially the gals in my little progressive group, will believe anything he has to say. And then she sent me a piece by Mike Whitney at Op-Ed. Here's the real reason they destroyed Strauss-Kahn. And I'll get to that in a second. But going back to Steve Clemens' piece at the Washington Note, he has this little incident. I want you to hear this. He writes, at the inaugural meeting of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, held at King's College in Cambridge, England, Strauss-Kahn spoke as one of the keynote speakers. As his remarks began, an anti-IMF protester had broken into the hall, protesters, and hung a banner over the stage in front of 200 or so surprised economic thinkers and writers. I was in the second row and snapped the picture, and there's a picture of it here, which I quickly fed to Arianna Huffington, who in turn had it up as the lead on Huffington Post in about 3 minutes. What followed was Strauss-Kahn showed no fear at all of these protesters, whom he engaged in discussion. He asked them to make clear their concerns, to use his stage to articulate their core fears and demands and make this time that they had count. Unfortunately, the folks hanging the banner were not those most intellectually in tune with the protest, and they ran off after he asked them to speak. I had communication with the protest leaders later and have no doubt that they would have done well in response to Strauss-Kahn, but the key then is that he actually did think they should be heard and that the elite who had assembled should not forget the voices of those worried about the impact of global economic policymaking. It was a powerful moment, deftly managed by Strauss-Kahn. What is clear is that Strauss-Kahn, who was one of the few major economic gladiators in the world to defend the rights and privileges of people, is human himself. We sometimes forget that. And also in this, end of quote from Steve Clemens at the Washington Note, from Juan Cole from his blog the other day, quote, what is it about the United States that makes for harsh prosecutions over sex crimes but lets leaders off the hook when it comes to war crimes? New York police rushed to arrest Dominique Strauss-Kahn, the head of the International Monetary Fund, on Saturday on learning of charges against him of sexual assault. This quick action against a wealthy and powerful individual seeking justice for a person at the bottom of the rung of the American social hierarchy, the maid, is praiseworthy. It affirms the principle that no one is above the law. But the widows and orphans of Iraq cannot hope that the New York police would similarly frog march George W. Bush off his first-class flight and arrest him for crimes against humanity. A post from, this is at the Daily Beast. The principle of innocent until proven guilty is, of course, a far less dangerous territory than the contemporary barbary potentially threatening all of us. A unison of accusations, condemnations, rumors, and suggestions produced, distributed, and amplified through a global mass media environment in the weeks and months before the case is brought to a courtroom. Another post at the Daily Beast. Yes, Dominique Strauss-Kahn now stands guilty in many minds until he proves himself innocent. There are reports of Strauss-Kahn's alleged womanizing surfacing everywhere. Also reports of an alleged previous attack. He has been reduced to disgrace in wild YouTube videos. One is no longer innocent until proven guilty. One is guilty until proven innocent. Even if Strauss-Kahn were to be found not guilty, his reputation and career is in ruins, and so it goes. How many examples are there? There's something else here. Yeah, and then Mike Whitney also published at Information Clearinghouse. And some of this I want to share with you. He writes, I have no way of knowing whether the 32-year-old maid who claims she was attacked and forced to perform oral sex on IMF Chief Dominique Strauss-Kahn is telling the truth or not. I'll leave that to the braying hounds in the media who have already assumed the role of judge, jury, and Lord High Executioner. But I will say, the whole matter smells rather fishy, just like the Elliot Spitzer story smelled fishy. Spitzer, you may recall, was Wall Street's biggest adversary and a likely candidate to head the SEC, a position at which he would have excelled. In fact, there's no doubt in my mind that if Spitzer had been appointed to lead the SEC, most of the top investment bankers on Wall Street would presently be making license plates and rope-soled shoes at the federal penitentiary. So there was plenty of reason to shadow Spitzer's every move and see what bit of dirt could be dug up on him. As it turns out, the ex-governor of New York made it easy for his enemies by engaging a high-priced hooker named Ashley Dupree for sex at the Mayflower Hotel. When the news broke, the media descended on Spitzer like a swarm of locusts, pouring over every salacious detail with the ebullient fervor of a randy sixth grader. Meanwhile, the crooks on Wall Street were able to breathe a sigh of relief and get back to doing what they do best, fleecing investors and cheating people out of their life savings. Strauss Kahn had enemies in high places, too, which is why this whole matter stinks to high heaven. First of all, Strauss Kahn was the likely candidate of the French Socialist Party who would have faced Sarkozy in the upcoming presidential elections. The IMF chief clearly had a leg up on Sarkozy, who has been battered by a number of personal scandals and plunging approval ratings. But if Strauss Kahn was set up, then it was probably by members of the Western Bank Coalition, that shadowy group of self-serving swine whose policies have kept the greater body of humanity in varying states of poverty and desperation for the last two centuries. Strauss-Kahn had recently broke free from the so-called party line and was changing the direction of the International Monetary Fund. His road to Damascus conversion was championed by progressive economist Joseph Stiglitz in a recent article titled "The IMF Switch in Time." It just goes on and on. And then there was something else that Strauss Kahn had started talking about. Removing the dollar as the reserve currency. And this also was written by, who wrote this? I think this was Mike Whitney too at Op-Ed News. He writes, it's about the dollar. That's right. Strauss-Kahn was mounting an attack against the dollar, and now the wrath of the empire has descended on him like a ton of bricks. I'll do this when we come back. Let's do this break, and we'll be right back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Let Mike Malloy do it for you.
21 past the hour. This hour is sponsored by James Higgins. Thanks, James. No message, just a sponsorship. Thank you. So, writing at, or carried at, Op-Ed News, Mike Whitney. He posts a little scoop from the Telegraph of the UK. Here's what it says. Quote, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, managing director of the IMF, has called for a new world currency that would challenge the dominance of the dollar and protect against future financial instability. Now, that subordinate phrase there, protect against future financial instability, I think that's a subordinate phrase, is just chock-a-block with insinuations, and they're good ones. When you have people in this country who manipulate the dollar to the extent that it is manipulated, these thieving sons of bitches who should be put in a hole, the globe's future financial stability or instability is at risk. So the UK says DSK had called for a new world currency that would challenge the dominance of the dollar and protect against future financial stability. He suggested adding emerging market countries' currencies, such as the yuan in China, to a basket of currencies that the IMF administers could add stability to the global system. Strauss-Kahn saw a greater role for the IMF's special drawing rights, which is currently composed of the dollar, the sterling, the euro, and the yen over time, but said it will take a great deal of international cooperation to make that work. End quote, the UK Telegraph. So Mike Whitney writes in, so Strauss-Kahn finds himself in the same crowd as Saddam Hussein and Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi, right? You may recall that Saddam switched from dollars to euros about a year before the war 12 months later, Iraq was invaded, Saddam was hanged, and the dollar was restored. Gaddafi made a similar mistake when he initiated a movement to refuse the dollar and the euro and called on Arab and African nations to use new currency instead, the gold dinar. Libya has since come under attack by U.S. and NATO forces, blah, 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 blah. And now it's Strauss-Kahn's turn to get torn to shreds, and for good reason. After all, he actually poses a much greater threat to the dollar than either Saddam or Gaddafi because he's in the perfect position to shape policy and persuade foreign heads of state that replacing the dollar is in their best interests. And that is precisely what he was doing, bad-mouthing the buck. Only he was too dense to figure out that the dollar is the U.S. Mafia's meal ticket, the main way that shifty banksters and corporate scalawags extort tribute from the poorest people on earth. Strauss-Kahn was rocking the boat, and now he's going to pay. Now, at the same time, also at Op-Ed News, is a piece by Greg Palast that is not flattering of Strauss-Kahn at all, under the headline, Strauss-Kahn Screws Africa. Greg Palast is goes after Strauss-Kahn for his what the IMF has been doing in Guinea. I would just suggest you go to opednews.com and read both of these articles if you want to if you want to get yourself real confused. Now, let me make sure that I'm clear here. You know, someone who commits assault, especially what is called sexual assault, deserves, in my opinion anyway, the full force of the law, for sure. There's no question about that, none whatsoever. And as far as the presumption of innocence, if George W. Bush were arrested tomorrow and charged with war crimes, would you grant him the presumption of innocence? No, and the reason is very simple. We've had a front row seat. We've watched his war crimes being committed. We know about his lies. So there is a difference. Before you run that one on me in one of your emails and say, well, would you grant George Bush a presumption of innocence? The answer to that is hell no. I witnessed what George W. Bush did. He's guilty, period. As far as this French socialist, DSK, it just seems all too convenient, doesn't it? I mean, I had no idea that, first of all, that he was apparently a market socialist. I had no idea that he had suggested the dollar be replaced. I was aware after the fact of his arrest. I never heard of him until his arrest, which speaks volumes about me and my ignorance. But when I heard after his arrest that he had that his plans for the IMF were not the typical neoliberal plans where the banksters and the thugs and the sons of bitches and the global capitalists would continue to rape and pillage, then all of a sudden it was like, oh, really? Now, I have great respect for Greg Palast, and I've only skimmed his piece at Op-Ed News about the bad DSK, whereas Mike Whitney writes about the maybe not bad DSK. I don't know. I'll tell you what. When we come back from this break, let's take a quick hiatus from all this, and we'll do podcast trivia. If you want to play, get online right now, 877-996-2556.
America, one flying monkey at a time. It's More Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. This hour is sponsored by James Higgins. Thank you, James. Thank you, James. James Higgins is our sponsor. All right, I think it's time for podcast trivia. Yeah, it is, isn't it? There's that music. Once again, time to play podcast trivia, where you can win 1 year subscription to Malloy program podcast downloads free, commercial free, in your mailbox every morning. Even the nights when we have screw-ups here and you get blank recordings. We do it all. It's all yours free. All you have to do is guess the right answer to our question. You ready to play? Scott is in Detroit, listening on XM. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
All right. How are you?
Not bad. Michigan's hurting.
Oh, yeah.
Our governor is, I'm not going to use the word.
Well, good.
Very disappointed.
Good, good, because we're not just on XM. If we were only on XM, you could use any word you want. But all right, Scott, are you ready to do podcast trivia?
I'm ready, Mike.
All right. Now, this question is rather lengthy, so let me just get it all out, okay?
All right.
All right. Tomorrow is a big day for members of a certain religious cult. It is the day they expect to float into heaven to be with their God. Is this religious cult A, Buddhism, B, Hinduism, C, Scientology, D, Judaism, E, Christianity, F, Animism, G, Baha'i, H, Confucianism, L, Mormonism, J, Shintoism, K, Sikhism, L, Taoism, M, Islam, N, Paganism, or O, Zoroastrianism.
Wow, that's a lot of isms, Mike. I'm going to have to go with D, Christianity.
You're absolutely right, Scott. Oh, my God. I just thought the question was a funny one, but that's all right. Okay, now you, Kathy says you also have a comment. Sure.
Love your show. Been listening since the Air America days. I never actually got through where I could talk to you, and I'm absolutely thrilled. And, I'm a big fan of Peter Werby's, too, an old friend of yours.
Yeah, Peter.
He's still on the air here.
Well, he'll be on the air long after the rapture. Yeah, Peter's got quite a history in Detroit. I don't know how many people know his history as an activist in that city, a labor activist. He's a good guy. He's one of the few good guys on the radio, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yes, he's been on a long time, and there's far few too many voices like yours and his out there.
Well, if you have occasion to call his program, tell him Malloy said hey.
Oh, I certainly will. Yeah, he's on Sunday night.
Yeah, he is. Yeah.
Could I tell the audience if they wanted to listen?
Sure.
Since it's not a night you're on the air.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's on WRIF, Detroit. You can Google it. I think it's WRIF.com, mm-hmm. And they do live stream his show, and it's on at 11 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm WRIF, and I believe it goes till 2 a.m., and he has call-ins, and usually does an interview or two at the end of the show.
Yeah, R-I-F, like Frank, WRIF.com. Yeah.
WRIF, The Riff.
The Riff, all right. Now you had a comment.
I just said I love your show, and I've been a big fan for a long time, and I'm thrilled to death that you finally let me on. Thank you.
All right, Scott, hold on now. Don't hang up. Hold on. Kathy will get the information. And thanks a lot, Scott. We appreciate you playing podcast trivia.
Didn't he have a comment?
He already made his comment. It was about Peter.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I don't know. Buddhism, Hinduism, Scientology, Judaism, Christianity, Animism, Baha'i, Confucianism, Mormonism, Shintoism, Sikhism, Taoism, Islam, Paganism, Zoroastrianism. I'm sure I left a couple out there. All sorts of indigenous religions. Oh, well. All right. The bit about Dominique Strauss-Kahn, DSK, as he's known in the upper circle. You know, I don't know. I don't know about this guy. I don't know. And if he committed a sexual assault against another person because he felt he could, then let the full force of the law come down on him. I certainly have no problem with the law taking its course. I think it's fair to say that given this voracious, hungry, vicious global media that we have, especially in this country and especially on the web, the presumption of innocence, of course, is a quaint, nonsensical idea. It just doesn't exist anymore. You know that as well as I do, especially where it concerns charges of sexual activity. We have seen the political class in this country, mostly Republicans, but certainly Democrats, also the hypocrisy and the viciousness of what they do to their underlings, the people they consider to be their underlings, whether they're male or female. And we also all know that throughout history, the quickest way to destroy somebody's reputation when you live in a very repressed, effed up society like this one is to charge them or accuse them of sexual crimes. Once the charge is made, then of course the person has to prove his or her innocence rather than the state proving guilt. Come on, we know this. I don't know that much about Strauss-Kahn. Greg Palast has things to say about him. Prairie 2 has things to say about him. Mike Whitney has that, you know, the people whose interest, lie in that direction have a hell of a lot more information about him and the IMF than I do. I just know from living in this country for the past, decades that when somebody gets in the way of the capitalist meat grinder, well, they don't call it a capitalist meat grinder for nothing. And they will be brought down, period. That's just the way it works. They will be destroyed. Now, again, if this man, if it turns out that he's guilty as charged, then the law should dictate his consequences, just as it would yours or mine or anybody's. And if there is a person here, a housekeeper at a hotel for the ultra wealthy, who has been hurt and embarrassed and scared and assaulted, then she should receive justice. And justice would be whatever attack was leveled against her can't be undone. The only justice would be for her to know that her attacker is being punished. But I don't know. There's just something, there's a repetitive quality about people who appear to be attempting to modify, upset, change, dislodge these capitalist predators. There just seems to be a repetitive action. You can almost count on it. You get someone who, if that's what DSK was attempting to do, someone who is attempting to kick a hole into this monolithic predatory capitalism, they usually wind up destroyed. So I guess it will play out the way it will play out, and I'm not using that term play out in order to denigrate anyone involved in this. So, all right, that's all I want to say until the man goes on trial. Like I said before, I don't like those particular topics at all. It's a little early to start the music. I think we still have a little time left here before we go out on a break. I apologize for the raspy sound here and the throat clearing. Somehow I picked up strep throat. It has not been pleasant. All right, now we'll be back directly. Stay with us.
Radio matters here.
10 before the hour. This hour has been sponsored by James Higgins. Thank you, James. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told Barack Obama today that any chance of peace between the Israelis and Palestinians is ridiculous to even think about. And he listed a series of non-negotiable conditions. That is the same old, same old. You know, I've said it before on this program. There is no way. There are two, if we step back a second, if this is possible, two disparate cultures who claim the same piece of ground is their homeland, and they're willing to die for it, and to kill for it. More importantly, they're willing to kill for it. There is no solution. Netanyahu is in the States. He will be addressing AIPAC tomorrow, or is it Sunday? And so will maybe he'll be. I don't know. Obama is going to be addressing AIPAC, which is ludicrous. They're trying to do everything they can to destabilize Obama's government and get him out of office. But the New York Times reports it this way. Sitting at Mr. Obama's side in the Oval Office, leaning toward him and at times looking him directly in the eye, the Israeli leader bluntly rejected compromises of the sort Mr. Obama outlined the day before in hopes of reviving a moribund peace process. Mr. Obama stared back. Netanyahu warned against, quote, a peace based on illusions, end quote. Netanyahu said that Israel would not accept a return to the boundaries that existed before the war in 1967, gave it control of the West Bank and Gaza, calling those borders now indefensible. And the reason for that, of course, is there's, what, 250,000 Israeli Jews who live in settlements outside those borders, who would not be living in Israel if those borders were accepted. So you can understand, this was the whole idea, though, to, against UN resolutions, to make these settlements so that when this day would come, and this day is here, that talk about returning to the 1967 borders, and Obama's the first president, American president, to do that, then there would be this grand reason why that is impossible from the Israeli side. It cannot be done. Netanyahu said, quote, remember that before 1967, Israel was all of 9 miles wide. He was referring to the narrowest point between the West Bank and the Mediterranean north of Tel Aviv. And he said, these were not the boundaries of peace. They were boundaries of repeated wars. You know, this insoluble situation in the Middle East is is one of the most, if not the most important issue that is causing so many problems in this country with our foreign policy. It has corrupted our legislative branch of government entirely. It is causing problems around the globe. When you stop and think, if you can, calculate the number of deaths that have resulted directly and indirectly from the situation in Israel-Palestine over the last 63 years, I think you would find that the number of deaths is huge. But when you stop and consider not just the confusion and the rage and the killing that continues even as we speak tonight, again, directly and indirectly, as a result of how the United States, the United Kingdom, set this situation up 65 years ago. And has refused over that entire period of time to act as mediators in a situation that they created to try to bring some sort of resolution. Now, you can make the argument, I think I just did, that there is no solution. There is no solution to this. This will continue until every Israeli Jew, every Palestinian Arab is dead. That's the sense that I get sometimes. I've been watching this. I can remember the 67 war when I lived in Raleigh, North Carolina. And how I cheered for the Israeli side. I didn't know anything about the politics of the Middle East. All I knew was that this little tiny country had was on the verge of being attacked by four nations, and that their counterattack or their preemptive strike was so efficient, so thorough, that it just beat the living hell out of these people. I didn't know who these people were. I didn't know anything about the political implications of the Middle East. And I don't think very many Americans do. I really don't. And over a period of time, you know, I had some people, Jewish, Palestinian, provide me with information so I could take a look at both sides and come to a conclusion. And the conclusion I've come to is there's no solution here. There is no solution. It's not going to be worked out. It just is not. Not now, not next month. It doesn't matter who the president is. It doesn't matter who is the head of the Israeli government. Not ever will this be settled. It is beyond settling. I mean, if, you know, if your grandmother's antique vase falls off the top of a shelf someplace and shatters into a million pieces, that's it. It's over. It's broken. It's done. Forget about it. But there is a little bit more to this story, and I'm going to once again take the risk of the vicious, you dirty Jew-hater emails that I usually get around this topic and talk about it when we come back. So stick around. I'm Mike Malloy. back, 7 past the hour. This is the Beloit program. This hour is sponsored by Clinton Heiter. Would you pronounce that Heiter or Heiter? I forget what that rule is when you have two vowels together. Clinton Heiter. I think it's Heiter. Thanks, Clinton. Appreciate your sponsorship. Back to the intractable problem, the unsolvable problem, the sword in the side of, you know, just a huge portion, what am I trying to say, of the population of the planet, and that is the Israeli-Palestinian issue. It divides the UN. It causes grief around the globe. You take someone like Robert, was it Robert Goldstone? Was that his first name? The South African Supreme Court Justice who put together the Goldstone Report about the Israelis and the Palestinians in the last Operation Iron Fist or whatever it was when the Israelis killed 1,200 Palestinians and the Palestinians killed, I don't know, what, 30, 20, 10 Israelis. And the Goldstone Report accused both sides, but primarily Israel, of war crimes, prosecutable war crimes. And world condemnation fell on Justice Goldstone to have the absolute temerity to suggest that Israel had committed war crimes. So much of the world is hung on this this issue. If you want to believe that the people who attacked this country and the people who allowed the attack to occur on September 11, 2001, the attack was generated by our mistreatment of either Muslims or Arab speakers, but primarily our one-sidedness where it concerned the Middle East after 60 years. 70 years since the end of, since the end of World War I, the breakup of the Ottoman Empire, and then post-World War II. You can go back to the Balfour Declaration. You can find the Zionist movement in Russia, in the 1840s? I may have that wrong. But don't correct me, I'm just floating through all this. But the situation is not solvable. And Obama, first U.S. president since the 67 war, to say, look, you know, return to those borders, Israel, and the Palestinians, you're going to have to agree to the sanctity of those borders. And, of course, that is met on the Palestinian side with less than enthusiasm, on the Israeli side with outright rejection. So Obama didn't back away from his proposals, even though Netanyahu is sitting there. And despite all kind of criticism from, you know, the pigs in our legislative department, the pigs who are the Republicans, and the Democrats who happen to be Jewish in the American legislative branch in the House and the Senate, almost to the last person, fiery Zionists. So Obama is sort of out there. He made his declaration, and now he will be ripped to pieces. Today he again said that the turmoil going on there in the Arab, the so-called Arab Spring, all these revolutions that are attempting to succeed. The one in Egypt certainly didn't. They got rid of Mubarak, but what do they have now? Military dictatorship? I guess the one in Tunisia. I don't even know what's happening in Tunisia. But Obama, again today, called the region's turmoil what he referred to as a moment of opportunity to promote democracy and stability. Well, maybe, except for the fact that, you know, when you have these dictatorial regimes, on the one hand, the Arab, the ones we support. I mean, what is the difference between Gaddafi and the Saudi royal family? Somebody tell me. What's the difference between the Jordanian king and the Assyrian dictator? What's the difference? Anyone want to tell me? Well, you know what the difference is. So it is understandable why people in the Middle East and in North Africa who are involved in these fights to the death. Look at the United States response with more than a little skepticism, wouldn't you think? Obama said, even though there is this moment of opportunity, he said, quote, there are significant perils, indeed. Obama, according to the New York Times, has not directly discussed his new peace effort with the Palestinians, including the president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas. Though lower-level American diplomats have, the Palestinian reaction so far has been relatively muted. Nabil Sha'ath, the leader of Mr. Abbas's party, said that Mr. Obama's speech had, quote, contained little hope for the Palestinians, end quote. Obama reassured Netanyahu that Israel's security would remain paramount in any American push to resolve the conflict. Well, see, there you go. Well, Obama said, quote, our ultimate goal has to be a secure Israel state, a Jewish state, living side by side in peace and security with a contiguous, functioning, and effective Palestinian state. Obviously, he went on, there are some differences between us in the precise formulations and language, and that's going to happen between friends, end quote. And then Obama joined Netanyahu in raising concerns about Hamas. Yeah, remember, you know, when you tell people to go ahead and go for democracy and they vote in a ruling party that you don't like, what do? Do you say, no, not that kind of democracy? That's what happened with Hamas in Gaza. Now, Hamas is at odds with Fatah, the other part of the Palestinian factions that control, Fatah controls the West Bank and the Palestinian Authority itself. Hamas recently said, okay, let's be friends because we have a common enemy, I guess. Obama said, quote, Hamas has been and is an organization that has resorted to terror, that has refused to acknowledge Israel's right to exist. It is not a partner for a significant, realistic peace process. So Obama, you know, I mean, do you not hear yourself, Mr. President? Hamas, Fatah, these organizations are the ones that the Palestinian people have chosen to be their leadership. So, but of course, you know, the arrogance of the United States, the arrogance of the Israelis, says to the Palestinians, your right to self-determination is secondary to, you know, Israel's right to exist. What other country on earth declares a right to exist? I'm just curious. You know, until I started hearing that 40 years ago, Israel's right to exist, I don't know of any other country that declares that or says we have a right to exist. And I guess it's based on religion. So we're back to that. Netanyahu characterized Hamas as the Palestinian version of Al-Qaeda and refused to hold any talks with the Palestinians if Hamas was included. This is what pisses me off. Isn't Netanyahu the head of the Likud party, maybe not the head, but his party, the Likud party, Likudniks, isn't that the political party inside Israel that Netanyahu represents? Likud? You know, the Likud party is descended from a terrorist organization, an absolute terrorist organization, as bloody as anything it could be laid on Hamas or any other Israeli organization. Are you aware of that? We'll talk about that when we come back. I'm Mike Malloy. Yeah.
just had another cup of coffee. Here's Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. This hour is sponsored by Clinton Hyder. Clinton, I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Thank you. Netanyahu and Obama, and both of them declaring to each other that a solution to the horror in the Middle East will never be reached. Not on their watches, not ever. The demands are intractable. The expectations are that the other side will die. And you know where that gets you. Anyway, the talk about Hamas, you know, the world leadership agrees that Hamas is a terrorist organization and they don't have any business having anything to say about anything. The Irgun, which was short for the National Military Organization in the Land of Israel. That's how it translates out of the Hebrew. It was a Zionist paramilitary group that operated in the British Mandate of Palestine between 1931 and 1948. And it was the offshoot of an earlier paramilitary organization called the Haganah. Irgun members were absorbed into the Israeli Defense Forces at the start of the 1948 Arab-Israeli War. The Irgun policy was based on what was then called revisionist Zionism, founded by Ze'ev Jabotinsky. According to a biographer, quote, the policy of the new organization was based squarely on Jabotinsky's teachings, which was every Jew had the right to enter Palestine. Only active retaliation would deter the Arabs. Only Jewish armed force would ensure the Jewish state. And some of the better known attacks carried out, end of quote, carried out by the Irgun was the bombing of the King David Hotel in Jerusalem in 1946. The what is referred to as the Deir Yassin massacre. That was a area of I think it was a Palestinian town, village. I don't know. I should have done my research on that. In April of 1948, where Palestinians were massacred, the State of Israel in 1948 declared Irgun to be a terrorist organization. However, Irgun was the political predecessor to Israel's right-wing Herut or Freedom Party, which led to today's Likud Party. Likud has led or been part of most Israeli governments since 1977. Now, I don't make that point to bust up on the Israelis. I'm just saying the Irgun, which became, through a series of changes, the Likud, of which Netanyahu is their public face. It was Likud Party that put him in office. He's a member of Likud Party. When they referred to Hamas as a terrorist organization, what the hell was Irgun? What about the Stern Gang? Remember the Stern Gang? It was founded in 1940 by Abraham Stern after a split from Irgun. It was extremely anti-British. The group repeatedly attacked British personnel in Palestine and even invited aid from the Germans, from the Axis powers. They were willing to do business with the Nazis. The British police retaliated by killing Stern in his apartment. Many of the gang's leaders were subsequently arrested. The group's terrorist activities extended beyond Palestine. Two members assassinated Lord Moyne, a British minister of state in the Middle East, in Cairo. Later, the Stern Gang attacked airfields or railway yards, other strategic installations in Palestine, usually with success. After the creation of the State of Israel, the group, which had always been condemned by moderate leaders of the Jewish community in Palestine, the group was suppressed, some of its units being incorporated in the Israeli Defense Forces. Unlike the Irgun, which ultimately became Likud, the Stern Gang had no political party to carry on its political programs. And the reason I mention that is that, you know, when they talk about, it wasn't George Bush who pushed for free elections in Gaza. Oh, yeah, we're going to have democracy in Gaza. And what do the Gazans do? They elect their leadership from the Hamas party. How is Hamas different from Irgun or the Stern Gang or Haganah? How? How is it different? You know, in 1940, when the Palestinians, if they would have demanded that the Stern Gang recognize the Palestinians' right to exist, how much laughter would that have caused? Or if the Palestinians would have said to any of these organizations that were bombing and blowing up and attacking and destroying Palestinian villages, throwing people out, attacking the British, blah, 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 on and on and on. Supposing somebody would have stepped out and said, wait a second, we demand that you recognize our right to exist. The point I'm trying to make is the ludicrousness of that to the people in that area who are not Jewish, who are not Israelis. You know, the question comes, why do you have a right to exist and we don't?
Conservatives, don't be afraid. Be very afraid. It's Mike Malloy.
The Lord Jesus Christ himself.
25 before the hour. This hour is sponsored by Clinton Heater. I hope I'm pronouncing your name right. Or Heiter. Oh, God. Sorry, Clinton, but thanks for the sponsorship. I'll close off that Israeli-Palestinian madness, just with the comment, email here from Jan, who happens to be Jewish. Mike, one major reason that the Israel-Palestine conflict is not solvable is because of the tremendous power of the Israel lobby, a lobby that certainly appears to put the interests of Israel above that of the United States. Netanyahu, as well as prior Israeli governments, have long shown that their interest is really not in peace, but in grabbing as much Palestinian land as possible, with as few Palestinians on that land as possible. Sadly, with few exceptions, the U.S. government has refused to condemn Israel's intransigence, ongoing land grab, and murderous wars responsible for the deaths of many thousands. It seems that there is nothing Israel can do that will raise the ire of the American government enough to do what they should do. Treat Israel in the same way that apartheid South Africa was treated, with boycott, divestment, and sanctions. As for the boogeyman Hamas, it is time for Israel and the United States to understand that had it not been for years of brutal occupation, there would be no Hamas. It is the occupation that created Hamas, just as the British occupation of Palestine created the Jewish terror groups Irgun and Stern Gang, who did their best to kill both British soldiers and Arab civilians. My heart is heavy for all the people of the region, for those good Israelis who want an end to their country's oppression of the Palestinians, and for the Palestinians who, if the U.S. does not change its policies, will never have their state, unless it is a series of Israeli-controlled apartheid South Africa Bantustans to which our so-called democratic government will never object. Peace, Jan. Every time I see an American president and an Israeli prime minister sit for the photo op in the Oval Office, I don't care who the president is, I don't care who the prime minister is. It just, I don't know, I don't mean this the way it sounds. I mean it more literally. It turns my stomach. That's the expression, right? It makes me faintly nauseous. Because I know that the hatred and the divisiveness and the killing and the suicide bombers and the attacks by the IDF is just going to continue and continue and continue. And again, you know, if you pause to think how far-reaching that conflict actually is, where it concerns not just U.S. foreign policy, but the foreign policy of so many states in Europe, the attitudes of Arab speakers, Muslims around the globe, all because of that. I mean, think about it, really, or don't. It doesn't matter to me. I'm just saying, the Israeli-Palestinian death struggle is just so much more than what it appears to be. And the weird thing to me is how few Americans give it any thought whatsoever. Just nothing. American Jews think about it for the obvious reasons. Either the American Jews are pro-peace or they're pro-Israel. Pro-peace can be pro-Israel, but you know what I'm saying. So American Jews look at it that way. America's non-Jews don't even think about it. The Christians, let's put it, the Christians, they don't even think about it. The crazy Christians only see the Israeli situation as some little piece in their mosaic of death and destruction that's supposed to bring their Messiah back. It's just madness. It's just madness. Would that we had leadership in this country, in Israel, that would bring this to a conclusion. But there is no conclusion, so I guess I should stop saying that. There is no conclusion. There is no conclusion that will satisfy the so-called both sides in this particular issue. It's just not there. It's not there. One-state solution never happened because then Israel is no longer a Jewish state. Two-state solution never happened because then the Palestinians have to give up what they consider to be their homeland. A percentage of it. It's just not going to happen. Let me move on. God. Do you remember, I think it was last week, we reported on the high school girl, Amy Myers, in New Jersey. I think it was in New Jersey. Yeah, Cherry Hill, at a high school, Cherry Hill, New Jersey, who challenged Michelle Bachmann to a public debate on the basic facts of the U.S. Constitution. Remember that? She had said in her challenge, Representative Bachmann, the frequent inability you have shown to accurately and factually present even the most basic information about the United States led me to the challenge. And she wrote that in an open letter to the this crazed Tea Party woman who knows nothing. I mean, she's one of the most ignorant people. She makes, and this is really difficult, she makes Sarah Palin look like she has a sense of history or geography or global events. I mean, that's how bad Bachmann really is. Bachmann's fans didn't take this 16-year-old young woman's challenge very kindly, and now, as right-wingers, teabaggers, Republicans, conservatives, I know because I've got a whole file here, what they always do, they're starting to threaten her life. That's right. Tea Party websites, posters on Tea Party websites have threatened to publish her home address. They've threatened violence. They've called her a whore. They've threatened to rape her. Her father says he's concerned for his daughter's safety now. The Cherry Hill Courier Press newspaper reports that she has been threatened with violence, including rape, and that several posters threatened to publish her home address. Amy's school has reportedly also received threatening mail. The newspaper had planned to do a video interview with the girl who's running for a student government position, but a, quote, somewhat panicked-sounding Wayne Myers, her dad, phoned to cancel, citing the threats. Amy said, quote, they're targeting me just because I'm challenging Bachmann. End quote. A Facebook group called Ask Representative Michelle Bachmann to debate Amy Myers already has over 7,000 supporters. But this is what these right-wing sons of bitches do every time. I get these emails, and some of them get through the algorithm that I've put up to try to eliminate most of this garbage. But, you know, I always say to these people, you rancid sons of bitches, you want to challenge me or my family? Show up on my front porch. Come to my house, but make sure you're not the first one through the door, because the first one through the door gets a bullet right in the forehead. Trust me on that. And, you know, they disappear. Every time I show up on these filthy right-wing websites because I say something like, when is SEAL Team 6 going to drop in on George Bush? Because George Bush is certainly responsible for 1,000 times more death than Osama bin Laden. And sure enough, these little mouth-breathing dribble asses start sending me emails threatening me, threatening this, threatening that. And it's ludicrous because they are cowards. They are filthy little cowards. I get some of them when I try to respond. The ones who do get through, I try to respond. And of course, the email, they use phony emails. One person made reference to Alan Berg. And, you know, I wrote back and said, you want to get ass, bring ass. You threaten me about Alan Berg, you come over here, you come anywhere near me or my family, and you will be a chunk of raw meat. And, of course, the email just comes back to me because these cowards, that's what they do. So here, the 16-year-old girl, she issues a challenge to a half-witted, moronic representative of Congress who should no more be in Congress than some goddamn dog. Yeah, dog. Woof, woof. And Bachmann's chosen few start threatening to kill this kid, rape this kid, commit violence against this, she's a young woman, but you know what I'm saying. You cowardly skunks. You really are. You're just so disgusting. So disgusting. Man. But I couldn't believe that. I couldn't believe that story. I didn't even know about it. Michael and Roswell sent it to me talking about tribal attitudes. Yeah, I guess so. You know, this tribe that clusters around these right-wing monsters, these zombies, these cockroaches that roam through our political system right now. I mean, it's one thing to be a Republican that has some kind of sense, some kind of dignity, some kind of something, but these scum suckers don't have any of it. You'll be right back. Sparks fly from the fingertips. Before the hour, this hour has been sponsored by Clinton Heiter. Thank you, Clinton. I hope I pronounced your name right. Well, I just can't get over the, what time is it? It's 10 before midnight here in the East. I just want to say goodbye to the people in Australia who are dead now.
Is it 6 o'clock there?
Well, yeah, it's 11 o'clock. It's almost noon there. They're about 24 hours behind us.
6 p.m.
Oh, they haven't, no. No, it's tomorrow there. It's all...
Saturday at 6 p.m.
Well... All right, to our listeners in New Zealand and Australia,
6 hours.
Tahiti, goodbye. See, it looks like 2 hours and 10 minutes away from Morpheus the Dreamer here in the Malloy chat room. Says there's 2 hours and 10 minutes. Easter Island. God. Oh, this means blue is good. I wonder where blue is. Yeah. Well, anyway, to our listeners in that part of the world. No, wait a minute. No. What? Okay. All right. You're right. I guess it's about 10 o'clock in Saturday morning there now, or 11 o'clock Saturday morning. I wish I had a clock thing in front of me. So they'll get it first, huh? Or is this supposed to... 6 p.m. is the rapture. Why has this gotten so much attention? I don't know. I guess because it's just such weird times. This is what the psychopath Glenn Beck, I mean, this steals his thunder. I'm sure Glenn Beck is just thoroughly pissed off that this crazed cop, this, where did that come from? This crazed preacher came up with this, and Glenn Beck didn't. Okay, Jeff in Sydney, Australia just wrote in, Mike, it's 1:53 in Sydney right now. Yeah, it's 11:53 here. It's 1:53 tomorrow afternoon. Nothing's happened yet. I'm going to a rugby match now. Jeff. Thanks, Jeff. Okay, so they are 14 hours ahead of us. Is that right? Yeah, 14 hours ahead of us. And a day. Whew. But this is something like, the psychopath Glenn Beck should have come up with, you know, this rapture nonsense. Beck is going to Israel. I wonder if the Israelis understand, if they allow this freak into their country, that they're allowing in a psychopath who could go to the Wailing Wall or the Dome of the Rock and cause hundreds of people to die. Which is Beck's motive all the time, is to bring about, you know, the arrival of, the angel Moroni, I guess, escorting Jesus into Glenn Beck's next stadium event. But if I were an Israeli citizen and I found out Beck was coming to my country, I would immediately petition Netanyahu or somebody, keep this psychopath out. Because, you know, I think most people in Israel understand that the only reason they get support from the crazy Christians in this country is because it has to do with the crazy Christians' fulfillment of the return of the Messiah. And as is, the good Jews will tell you, the Messiah has never shown up yet. And the really good Jews will tell you that Israel doesn't even exist because it is up to the Messiah to establish the state of Israel. Go figure. Madness. It's just all madness, every bit of it. Whew. So anyway, all this attention that has been focused on this crazed 89-year-old freak, where does he live, in Oakland? Does he live in Oakland, California? I wonder if our... No, I was going to say something about our educational correspondent. Maybe going over and interviewing him Sunday. Oh, Lord have mercy. Well, there's always an out for these people. They can say, well, that we got so many conversions that God decided to spare everybody, and we'll try it again a decade from now. I guess. I don't know. It's just absolute madness. You know it is. I know it is. This would have been a good Glenn Beck scam. Wonder what Rick Santorum is going to be doing tomorrow. You know, Santorum is one of those crazy... you know, Christian Armageddonists. Oh, this is appropriate. Well, you all have a great weekend, and don't forget to get some of that healing salve from Alice down in Healing Hollers, and I'll see you Monday night. Take care. Keep it lit. Oh, I shouldn't have said that. I'm Mike Malloy. Millions of people I know, I guess, or don't know. Have a great weekend, Kevin Kinney, wherever you are, pal.